I'd like to tell you about some work I've been doing this year in Buffalo with Xinglei Li, Gino Biondini, and also with my thesis advisor, Bill Kath, who's at Northwestern. And we've been thinking about the dispersion-managed nonlinear Schrodinger equation, which has some nice physical problems that it models. And we're looking at the symmetries and the linearized modes of this problem with the goal of using the linearized modes for a nice practical application. So I'm going to start off by telling you about these lightweight systems we're interested in and defining dispersion management and describing it to you. In these systems, there are plenty of things that could go wrong in such a system. We're interested in the effects of noise on dispersion-managed lightweight systems. And eventually, we'll get to the dispersion-managed nonlinear Schrodinger equation, which is like an average version of the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. And I'll talk about the stationary solution that one can find for that and this important parameter, the map strength, that comes up. And finally, I will discuss the symmetries of the dispersion-managed nonlinear Schrodinger equation. With these symmetries, we can find conservation laws and corresponding modes of the linearized DMNLS equation. And finally, I will probably show you something that's maybe new for most of you, called a variance reduction technique called important sampling. And I'll look at important sample of Monte Carlo simulations. Okay, so if you're not familiar with these kinds of lightwave problems, basically, light is an electromagnetic wave, so it's described by Maxwell's equations. But now I'm interested in how light's behaving in the fiber, so I have to take into account some of the fiber properties. So I'm thinking about a single mode fiber or single transverse mode. Fiber has an intensity-dependent index of refraction. And then I'm also thinking about the fiber having small anomalous dispersion and also low loss. So if you take these properties into account and look at appropriate limits, we can come up with the nonlinear Schrodinger equation to describe how the light travels through fiber. And if you're familiar with the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, this version might look really strange to you, I would guess, because here I'm thinking about defining the light, a pulse of light in time, and propagating it spatially. So I want to convince you that this is sort of the logical way to do things physically, because so I'm starting at the front of the fiber, z equals zero, and I'm going to think about a pulse of light. Well, it's going to be some quick duration of the light I put in. That's going to describe my pulse of light, so maybe 100 picoseconds or 200 picoseconds. The light that goes in there is my initial pulse. And then I want to see what happens to this pulse as it travels down the fiber. So I'm going to sit on a retarded time frame with the pulse and watch it evolve spatially down the fiber. And if it's too distressing for you, you can switch it back in your head. So the nonlinear Schrodinger equation in fiber, if we're in the right sort of parameter regime, we'll have a balance of nonlinearity and dispersion, and we can actually get optical solitons to propagate in fibers. And that was first proposed in the early 70s and first shown in practice in the early 80s by Lynn Mollenhauer. So the benefits of optical solitons are really robust structures, and there's plenty of theory, both mathematically and physical theory, about what's going on there. The drawbacks, and this is for a soliton system or really for any system, is that the nonlinearity eventually is going to cause problems in a practical system. So there was a idea to mitigate some of the effects of the nonlinearity is to look at a fiber, so a long length of fiber. Typically, we're thinking about communication over the ocean, so thousands of kilometers, where I'm alternating sections of fiber, one with positive dispersion and the next section with negative dispersion. This alternating of dispersion in the link is called dispersion management. So this was first proposed in the 90s, and I guess if I don't reference someone, you can correct me. This was first proposed in the 90s, and now it's fairly commonly used in practice. And again, so we're thinking about a large span of fiber that's made up of sections with positive dispersion and sections with negative dispersion. And these sections, the dispersion in a given section of fiber might be really large, But the average dispersion that the light sees overall is pretty small still. The fiber, the light traveling through the fiber is still subject to this nonlinear index of refraction. Nonlinear index of refraction causes a phase, an intensity-dependent phase rotation. That's our nonlinearity. That's where the nonlinear term came into, got into the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. An idea for doing this is that we'll have a smaller peak intensity, or on average a smaller peak intensity, so our nonlinearity won't have as strong of an effect. There's another really interesting lightwave system called mode-lock lasers. It'll just be easier for me to discuss this problem in terms of one physical problem, but so I'm not going to describe the model for you, but it has the same basic properties. It experiences positive dispersion, negative dispersion, and cubic nonlinearity. So it's really a model for both systems. So when we vary the dispersion, now our dispersion coefficient in the nonlinear Schrodinger equation is not constant. So here I have that dispersion coefficient plotted for you as a function of distance, so down the length of the fiber. And so I'm looking at regions of high positive dispersion and large negative dispersion. And this is going to repeat periodically down the length of the fiber. And this causes an optical pulse to compress and expand as it travels down the fiber. And of course, how you design your map is going to depend on the system you want to model. So the system is going to be subject to noise. And there's all sorts of physical effects that could limit the performance of the system. Every system is subject to noise, though, because over a long distance, the signal loses some of its energy and it needs to be amplified. And this makes sense. The way I understand it, fiber, if you could make a window out of fiber, it would be transparent for tens of miles. So it's very nice material, where a window is going to become, if you had just a regular window, after about 4 feet, it's going to be opaque. So it's fairly low loss, but it still needs to be amplified. The amplification process is by stimulated emission. So basically, as far as we're concerned, the pulse of light is just amplified by adding a bunch of photons that are in phase. But whenever we do that, some of the photons aren't going to be in phase. And this is going to cause noise. And when we're looking at a system where we're combining noise and nonlinearity, even though our noise sources might be well known and well understood, when combined with nonlinearity, the results might be far from the statistics of the source noise. And in these systems, in both of them, both the communication system and the mode-lock laser, we want errors to be extremely rare events. So if I'm sending pulses of light, I only want to incorrectly detect 1 in 10 to the 10th cent. So very few has to. You can only have very few errors. And for mode-lock lasers, the idea is you want to have really accurate frequency measurements, or you want to know the frequency of the laser very, very accurately, to 10 to the minus 17 or 18. So this is sort of the key point here. If each pulse of light in 10 to the 10th going down a fiber is subject to the same kind of noise, how does one time in 10 to the 10th, does that noise add up incorrectly and cause an error? So that's the idea. So it's crucial to understand the most likely noise realizations that lead to these desired rare events, these errors. And for a while in this talk, though, I'm just going to consider noise to be a perturbation and just look at perturbation theory and see what we can find out. So if we go back to the case with constant... and point of view of the PDE, I don't know from the point of view of the PDE, but let me describe to you what I think an error is. Okay, so it depends on how you're sending the information. So some typical ways, the two most typical ways are you send... I'll go quick. So we'll send a pulse of light to represent a 1 and no pulse of light to represent a 0. Okay, and then there's going to be at your detector, you're going to have some threshold. So if somehow the noise, you'd sent a 1, but the noise kicks the pulse down below your threshold, that's an error. And there are other modulation formats that depend on the phase and such, but But I think that's the most basic way to see it. Right, noise is forcing the equation. Noise is forcing the equation, and air would be at the end of when you detect the pulse. Does that answer your... Okay. So to go back to the constant dispersion case, we're looking... So we have the classic just such solution with the phase term. Here what's important, and what's important sort of based on his question, is that the solution is described in terms of these four parameters: amplitude, a tiny shift in our delayed time window, a frequency, and a phase term. So you hand me four parameters, and that's a perfectly good solution. So now, and these parameters arise from the invariances of the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, and so if I have a perturbation that causes exactly those parameter changes, that's still a perfectly good solution. That's a perfectly good solution. So if that happens here, if I keep getting perturbations that push my amplitude down, then I'm going to end up with an error, but the nonlinear Schrodinger equation can't resist that. So this is how a buildup of parameter changes can lead to really large distortion. And so we can think about this, though. So given a generic perturbation V to the solution, to the soliton solution, we can decompose that into changes to the four soliton parameters, and that's going to be proportional to the, or each, so it's going to be a change to the parameter times the mode associated with that parameter, the mode of the linearized equation, plus some dispersive radiation. So given a perturbation, I can tell you how much it's going to change each parameter. And these parameters are now our links between some perturbation and the parameter changes, or the linearized modes, excuse me. But now in the DMNLS case, we're varying the dispersion, and varying dispersion kills some of the symmetries in our problem. If we lose the symmetries, we lose the linear modes, and so we'd like to not lose the symmetries, so we want to get those back. And we can do that if we look at an averaged version of the nonlinear Schrodinger equation with varying dispersion, called the dispersion managed nonlinear Schrodinger equation. So to get to this equation, I'm going to do a multiple scales expansion about the dispersion coefficient, and then so I have a constant dispersion coefficient and then a varying term where I'm expanding in powers of the amplifier spacing. I should say the amplifier spacing corresponds to the dispersion map period. Okay, into a leading order, basically we get a pulse shape times this rapid phase term. This fast phase, that caused the breathing we saw in these pulses. And then the underlying shape is going to solve this dispersion-managed nonlinear Schrodinger equation, which is written down here in the Fourier domain. Typically, it's a little bit easier to work with this problem in the Fourier domain. And basically, it looks like the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, but now with a non-local term. And that integration kernel we just saw here, well, that sort of tells us how did this variant of the dispersion affect the nonlinearity. So if we consider a specific dispersion map, a piecewise constant two-step dispersion map, well, that's just a sinc function that depends. So our kernel will be a sinc function that depends on this parameter S that I'm calling the map strength. And the map strength is going to be really important in what proceeds. So the map strength just tells us on average how far is the dispersion from the average dispersion. So how far in each piece, how far is the dispersion away from the average dispersion? So how much are you varying the dispersion? And the map might be much more complicated. So if I look at a specific map, there's more things to take into account, like how large is the dispersion in one and how small in the other, where do I switch from positive to negative dispersion. But our problem only depends on this parameter's map strength. So that's really, really the key. So now I have the DMNLS equation in the temporal domain. I should mention that this kernel in the temporal domain is the two-dimensional Fourier transform of that sinc function. And here, and I should also mention that the subscripts refer to functional or to dependence instead of derivatives. So here we're looking at, we want to find stationary solutions. And so I'm going to have some pulse shape F times a phase, I'm going to call lambda here the soliton eigenvalue. And soliton is maybe I should use that word loosely in this description. But that's what it's referred to, so I'll just stick with that terminology. So here, now, if we plug this ansatz into the equation, we can find this shape, the shape of the pulse f, and it's going to solve this nonlinear integral equation. And actually, you can do that numerically with a modified Neumann iteration. We actually are using Pecfili's method to do that, which Marina talked about yesterday. And here is what this thing looks like. So I have it plotted. I'm looking at the time domain. I'm applying pulses, and I'm looking on a log scale, so it goes very low. And then I'm going back and increasing map strength. So initially, with map strength 0, I have just a regular nonlinear Schrodinger equation soliton, so I have a sketch. As we increase the map strength, the shape of this thing changes into something that's closer to a Gaussian with these oscillating decaying tails. And there's actually some maybe debate about this, but dispersion-managed solitons aren't actually that widely used in communication systems, but they're a really good starting point to study other arbitrary pulse shapes. And I should also mention that even though the solitons aren't necessarily used, the equation is still the equation that governs the system, so that's widely used. And for mode-locked lasers, the DMNLS equation has been experimentally verified to model the dynamics of that system. And for us, it's really nice also that the dispersion-managed nonlinear Schrodinger equation recovers the symmetries that we lost by varying the dispersion. So here, we're looking at the symmetry. Some are the same as for the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. So there's still a phase invariance, and those lead to the same conservation law. So we have a phase invariance, a translation invariance, or a time shift invariance, the way we formulated it, a Galilean invariance, and we have a new conservation law for scaling. And this thing is a little bit complicated, but what I want to focus on is that parameter, the map strength, shows up in the conservation law. So now, the conservation laws are nice, but we're really interested in these linear modes, because that's going to tell us what the perturbations do. So if I consider the Lagrangian density for the dispersion-managed nonlinear Schrodinger equation, well, if I look at the action on that density, of course, if I apply Euler-Lagrange equations, I'm going to get the PD back. But if I look at that action and I apply Noether's theorem, I can get those conservation laws. That's exactly how the conservation laws here, and that's sort of the standard way, as far as I understand, to get conservation laws like this. But Noether's theorem can do a lot more for us. So if we now look at the linearized Lagrangian density and look at that action, well, when we apply Euler-Lagrange equations, we get the linearized DMNLS equation. When we apply Noether's theorem, we get perturbed conservation laws, and we get these linear modes that we're interested in. And so each symmetry, we can sort of play the game with each symmetry, where we'll get a conservation law and a corresponding linear mode. So here I've written down the linearized DMNLS operator, which I think was first written down by Dimitri in 2000. Is that right? And if you're familiar with it, this looks pretty similar to the linearized nonlinear Schrodinger equation. The operator is not self-adjoint, and some of our modes are the same. So the timing, phase, and frequency mode are the same as they are for the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. The timing and phase mode are neutral modes, and the frequency mode is a generalized mode. The mode that corresponds to that soliton eigenvalue, lambda, which is analogous to amplitude for the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, this mode looks a little different. And here I've plotted it for you. Again, I'm looking at this mode defined on the time domain. Here I'm looking at a linear scale, and again going back in map strength. So you can see as we increase the map strength, the mode looks significantly different. So now we've done all this work to find these modes. I want to now use them to help us find rare events. So our goal is to predict error rates and understand why errors occur. And again, I mentioned this earlier, but error rates need to be really small. And simulating such rare events with Monte Carlo is, impractical is probably too weak of a word. It's really infeasible at such low error rates, at least with current computing power. You cannot do that well. But we know how noise changes the DM soliton parameters. And if I have parameter changes that are large enough, that'll lead to an error. So, and that was given to us by the linear modes. Now we're going to use these linear modes to bias our simulations to force errors to occur. Okay. So we're going to bias simulations to force errors to occur, but this raises questions. How probable are these rare events? And I'm cheating, right? I'm biasing simulations. So how can I take this into account? And the idea, the answer, is to use important sampling. So if you haven't seen important sampling before, here's a quick example. So I have this experiment where I flip a coin 100 times. I want to know the probability of hitting heads at least 70 times. Well, in that probability, you can calculate exactly. It's very small. So how do you simulate this directly? And the trick is to use a weighted coin. And we're going to weight it to hit heads 70% of the time. So now you're doing this experiment, or you're getting your kid brother to do this experiment, and you're flipping this coin. Well, normally when you flip coins, if you get a head, you have a one in the head column. You get a tail, you have a one in the tails column. If we count heads that much, though, we're going to be overcounting it because we've weighted the coin to give us heads more often. So we need to correct this with the likelihood ratio, which is the probability of the unbiased coin hitting heads to the probability of the biased coin hitting heads, and the equivalent thing for the tails. When we correct the statistics with the likelihood ratio, our simulations are speed up dramatically, and we get the statistics for a fair coin. So this is what we're going to do. So we're going to, I'll go through this quickly. So these linear modes are sort of our weighting. That's our idea of the weighted coin, is we're going to use these linear modes to find things that shouldn't happen too frequently. So here again, I'm decomposing a perturbation. Now I'm going to think of my perturbation as noise into changes to the parameters. If I want to isolate one of those changes, say the one to timing, I can multiply through by the adjoint timing mode, integrate both sides, and I can find each, given a perturbation, I can find the parameter change. And here, just since I'm using it, I've written down what the adjoint modes look like. Okay, so now we have this problem where I want to bias the noise with some function of time. Our noise is white Gaussian, and so we want to bias the mean of this noise, and we don't want to do this in any, we want to do this in a smart way, because we want to maximize the probability of hitting a parameter change we desire to cause an error. And the optimal way to do this is to bias proportional to the adjoint mode of the parameter you're seeking to change. Okay, so here's just a little toy example. So I have a DM soliton, I add noise to it. I don't know if you can see the red line, but that just is the mean, so it's mean zero. I get a noisy pulse. I have a DM soliton, I add noise to it. Here I've biased the noise with the adjoint amplitude mode with the adjoint amplitude mode, and that's going to give me a noisy pulse with its amplitude greatly reduced. Now at this point, if I was doing simulations, I would need to correct this with the likelihood ratio to give me the statistics for the unbiased simulations. Okay. So now this is what we're doing on a bigger scale. So I'm running full simulations. I'm not actually doing any approximations beyond numerical. So I'm simulating the full nonlinear PDE. An amplifier, I'm going to calculate the linear modes and bias the noise to produce the parameter changes I want. I do this continually until I reach the end of the line, and I correct my statistics with the likelihood ratio and get simulations for rare events directly. So here is a result for large changes to the frequency. So here I'm looking at the frequency parameter on the bottom versus probability. The black dots are 100,000 Monte Carlo, old-fashioned Monte Carlo simulations, of the nonlinear Schrödinger equation with the varying dispersion term still in it. The black curve is a Gaussian fit to those dots. And the pink curve is not a fit. That is an important sample simulation, with the solving the or using the dispersion management anomaly or Schrodinger equation. So we can push the noise to get down into the tails of the probability distribution using the those linear modes. And that's more or less what I say there. So thank you.